This is Dan Austin. This is an interview with Bowie Kuhn, former commissioner of baseball. This interview is for the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. The day is Monday, November the 16th, 1992. I'm at home with Mr. Kuhn in Point Verde Beach, Florida, a little bit south of Jacksonville. Thank you for accepting this invitation, Mr. Kuhn. And I would like to, because your background is an attorney, from what I read, that you were the NL League attorney before you became baseball commissioner. But how did you become the NL League attorney? Was that an accident, historical accident, or did you meet Walter O'Malley or somebody, and then you said, I'd like to get into sports law?
Well, let me, since this is an oral history, I guess I better get the pronunciation of my name.
I'm sorry.
Here at the beginning. It's pronounced Kuhn.
Excuse me.
And I wouldn't want people at Cooperstown to think I can't pronounce my own name.
No, anyway, I apologize.
It is pronounced Kuhn. And the whole history of my coming to be involved with baseball is fully detailed in Hardball. Mm-hmm. You'll find all of this in painful detail in Hardball. It really is just for your own immediate information.
Okay.
The product of my having gone to work for a firm called Wilkie Barr and Gallagher in New York. They represented baseball. It had nothing to do with Walter O'Malley at all. They represented baseball, and during the course of the time I was with the firm, I did some litigation work on baseball matters, working for some of the partners in the firm, and particularly for Lou Carroll, who was the counsel for the National League. I was not, but with his, in later years, when he became ill, I did become counsel of the National League shortly before a couple of years before I became commissioner. But all of this, Dan, is in Hardball and more detailed than anybody would want to know about, I suspect.
Okay. As we said just before we turn on the tape recorder, that the emphasis of the interview would be on the evolution of baseball sports law. And as I did my own reading, I thought, well, start with 1969, because you were faced with a very fundamental change in the whole legal structure of baseball, and that's the Curt Flood decision. I picked up an article in a law review that Curt Flood refused to leave the business interests he had developed during his years with the St. Louis Cardinals. And he wrote to you, he said, after 12 years of being in the major leagues, I do not feel I am a piece of property to be bought or sold irrespective of my wishes. And then he turned to Marvin Miller, who had come on a couple of years before as the executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association, to back his case. Now, you had to appeal that through all the courts. And, of course, the baseball owner's position at that time was upheld by the Supreme Court. Did you not have an inkling that within a short time that this was going to be overturned, that the way baseball players could be bought or sold was going to be changing despite that court ruling?
Well, let me go back a little bit to Flood. Again, you'll find the Flood case covered in Hardball in great detail. In point of fact, obviously the appealing was all done by Flood. Baseball won the case throughout. It wanted a trial and won it on appeal to the Circuit Court, and it went on appeal to the Supreme Court, so it was a continuous process of the union really behind Flood trying to crack through the baseball reserve system and failing. No, I really didn't have an inkling that any change such as came in 1976 would occur, and it seemed to me, as I described in Hardball, that the decision of an arbitrator in 76 was beyond his jurisdiction. It was wrong and was unsupportable, but it was a lucky fluke for the union that they were able to destroy the reserve system by what I thought was an erroneous arbitrator's decision. But again, all of that is detailed. What I did think would be coming in the 70s was some the modifications of the reserve system to make it fair to the baseball players. And that is why you got such things as the arbitration of disputes being ultimately put in the hands of an outside arbitrator, and the arbitration process, including an outside arbitrator like Peter Seitz, who did make the decision in 76. In addition, you had things like, you had many modifications of the reserve system that occurred in the 70s through negotiation, such as salary arbitration, which certainly gave a great fairness, I think, to the system. So yes, I anticipated an evolutionary change, and it came, and I thought it was fair.
When you say modifications, it seems at first glance either there was to be a reserve clause, or it was kind of a yes or no. It would either be completely dismantled, or it would be completely upheld. What kind of, well, of course, came later modifications, but what kind of, did you think about any modifications when you said that you thought it would be more fair and less injurious to the game?
Well, I never thought of it as being either a reserve system or no reserve system. That, in fact, is what was the potential effect of Seitz's decision to do that. But where you have a dispute, and whether it's in baseball or any place between management and labor, you would expect to see the relationship evolve, adjustments made, and so forth. And as I said a moment ago, in the case of baseball, there were modifications made, such as salary arbitration, such as permitting disputes to go or grievances to go to outside arbitrators, and other modifications were made. In the salary structure, for instance, the minimum salary and things such as that. And if one went back and looked at the collective bargaining agreements at the time, they would find, you know, you'd find other changes that were made. But it was an evolving process. Obviously, the union hoped to destroy the reserve system, and well, that what they did then with Seitz is history.
Mm-hmm. Kind of push up to 1992 very quickly. As a baseball fan, I wonder, I think of David Cone when he was signed the last month by the Toronto Blue Jays from the New York Mets, and now he's a free agent. That ball clubs are renting ball players by the month or the year. And then they go on to other fields. As a baseball fan, I wonder sometimes how you develop a kind of loyalty that I remember as a kid, saying, oh, these players are with that team, and I'm going to see through them through much of their career, although they could be traded. But you really had an identity of players with a particular team. And now, pretty hard-pressed to find out who's going to be playing with whom, let alone the expansion draft, I think, that begins today, and all the trades that will probably come with that. The players, I evidently did not think in terms of that whatsoever, in terms of what impact it would have on baseball fans. They were simply saying, hey, it's wrong, it's got to be dismantled, and we'll take our chances with what comes a result of it. I bring that up to you because the baseball commissioner supposedly is to represent everybody, including the baseball fan. That argument that I just share have no weight whatsoever in terms of making decisions about labor law in baseball, the role of the fan.
Well, I think it was always a flaw of the modified reserve system that emerged after Messersmith, that it provided, that by providing as much free agency as it did provide, that it would undermine the fans' confidence in the loyalty of athletes. Mm-hmm. That was a real problem. And I'm afraid that over the years that problem has been a real one and is perhaps even more impactful today than it ever has been. there are signs in 92 that maybe baseball's popularity is eroding somewhat. I think there is real question as to whether the ballplayers appearing to have the loyalty to cities is not a factor in that. So I think it's a matter of very real concern for professional baseball, for the fans, for the players, and for everybody.
Well, I sense that because the TV revenue contract will be expiring in another year, and there's already been talk about how much sharing of local TV revenue, if any, whether it be a lockout, whether it be another strike, caps on salaries. And living in a community that's going to have a new ball team come next April, I'm sure it's going to receive a tremendous amount of support, at least for a couple of years or so. But I really sense that baseball players and the owners are going to have to be more in tune with the public, so that the game is not jeopardized and its popularity can grow. And so I share that with you. And I really sense that people are saying, I'm fed up with obscene salaries. And at the same time, with the behavior of owners who, if they behave that way in their own businesses, would probably go broke. You don't have to respond to that, but that's just a feeling that, as a baseball fan, that in talking with other baseball fans. Marvin Miller, a very astute bargainer, came out of, I think, Pittsburgh as an organizer for the steel workers. I guess, do you have speaking terms with him?
Oh, I imagine I'm on speaking terms with him. I haven't seen him in years, okay. So I can't say I'm having any regular conversations.
You're not going out of your way. I say that because of some of the things that went back and forth. I understand that when the strike 1972, that he was shrewd enough to take into account the ability to compromise and that the strike was curtailed. Did you sense that posture, that feeling that he was, when it came down to it, they would really compromise and not injure the game any more than need to be?
Well, I don't think Miller had any real concern for the game itself, if that's what you're suggesting.
Yes, I am.
I don't think Miller had concern for the game. I think many of the players had a real concern for the game and still do. Miller himself, I don't think saw baseball as any different from any other business. I don't think he had any real sense of the traditions of the game, unlike a fellow like Dick Moss, who worked for him. Miller simply saw it as another labor assignment and handled it accordingly. I think that was a real problem with his leadership of the union.
But did he sense the public mood was swinging toward management in that strike of 72, and he said, hey, I better compromise? And
I don't think he worried about the public reaction. I don't think that he ever worried about the public reaction, except that he would try to manipulate it to put pressure on the other side where he thought he could. But I think from the point of view of the players, he wasn't concerned about what the public reaction was.
Okay.
Again, I think the players were, or many of the players were, but Miller, I think, was not.
Okay.
You ought to contrast Miller with somebody like the late Larry Fleischer, who was head of the National Basketball Association, Players Association. There was a man with a real concern for the league, for the welfare of basketball, and for the players as well. That was unfortunately not the style that Miller used, with the result that baseball is now having rather serious problems, not altogether attributable to Miller, but in part attributable to Miller, and basketball is soaring in popularity.
Maybe perhaps because of the salary cap that was initiated with the NBA and never became part of any acceptable discussion in Major League Baseball.
Well, the salary cap in basketball is certainly part of the reason for the success of the NBA today. But I think probably even more important is that given the very important role that the players have in any professional sport, Fleischer in leading the union respected the game, respected the public, and tried to handle his job in a way that was going to be for the benefit of all parties concerned. That was never Miller's approach.
In our all-star team of baseball sports law, I put down here the starting manager, owner, or I should say the starting owner, I put Charles O. Finley. I remember when Charlie O. Bought the Kansas City A's from Arnold Johnson, I believe in the very early 1960s or late 50s, I'm not sure. And we had colorful uniforms. We had goats grazing on the fences out there in the old Kansas City Municipal Stadium and a few other tricks. But when he tried to disband the Oakland A's after they won three straight World Series, and you stopped him short, that had been done before. Connie Mack had done that in the 1930s with the Philadelphia A's. Why did you, you know, there's precedence for it. The owner owns them. He could do what he wanted with them. But you said, no way. That's not in the best interest of baseball.
Well, I think your premise is wrong that the owner can do what he wants with his ball players. He can't. It's the commissioner's job to see to it that he doesn't do things, whether it's Bentley or anybody else, that are inconsistent with what is good for the game. And when Finley tried to sell off the ball players, he was quite obviously trying to dismantle his team. And that created a problem as far as I was concerned. They wouldn't have been letting him do it. And the difference between Finley doing it and what Connie Mack did, I think Connie Mack in effect did it twice. I think he also did it in the teens after he had a championship series of clubs. Mack was had financial problems. He wasn't getting rich by selling off his players. He decided that he was at the top of the market with those players, that he would be better off to dispose of them and try to rebuild a new team. No question that Mack was trying his best to rebuild a better team, or as good a team as the one he was selling off. 30s, for instance, he sold off veteran stars. I think he felt that they had probably taken him as far as they could take him. Finley, on the other hand, was trying to piecemeal sell his club off by disposing of the players, and then he was going to sell the franchise behind it. I think it was quite a different situation from what Mack had, had faced with his team. And in any event, the whole Finley story is, again, very much detailed.
Yeah, where you stopped the sale of Vita Blue to the Yankees, right, and Raleigh Fingers, and I think Joe Rudy to the Red Sox, if I remember correctly.
Right.
So you thought Charlie O was really trying to sell off a lot of the assets and then sell the franchise and then retire? And
right. It would be one thing if you simply wanted to sell the franchise. Any owner clearly has the right to do that as long as the buyer is an appropriate buyer. But Finley was trying to destroy the team simply in the interest of making money and then sell it. That was not acceptable.
Okay. I think in the 73 or 74 World Series, and the player's name I have forgotten, who was yanked by Finley, you know, he made an error or something like that.
Andrews,
that's right.
Mike Andrews.
And was publicly ridiculed, literally, by Charlie O for making that error or that bobble. You went to the defense very early, quickly in Andrews' situation.
Yes, I wouldn't let him put Andrews on the disabled list. There is no disabled list anyway for the World Series. Whatever players you go into the series with, the players you have, they can't be replaced. And it was just a transparent effort on Finley's part to do something he couldn't do anyway. Mm-hmm. Again, all completely detailed, Dan, and hardball.
Likewise with the Andy Messerschmidt case of the end of the reserve clause, a major reversal in the history of professional sports, well, professional baseball anyway, because it had been really immune from interstate commerce, the antitrust, and all of that. And although that's detailed in it, I'd like to, I guess, ask you, going to some of the other persons that you had to deal with, owners. And one of them, I've heard his nickname is called Captain Outrageous, Ted Turner, where you had to, should we say, slap his wrist for tampering. This was, I guess, the year after the end of the reserve clause. Would you give me the background? How did that come about? Was this something that happened in a hotel room or in a meeting that you heard about? Let me give you the background. The reason I asked, one of the law professors at the university has read a great deal about this case, and he says, Dan, when you meet with Mr. Kuhn, will you ask him, what are the details behind Ted Turner and your banning him or slapping his wrists and later banning him for 1 year?
It's really, all he has to do is read Hardball.
I will ask him to read Hardball.
Great detail, including the public remarks that Finley made about Matthews, who was a player of the Giants, he wanted to get, and he said, will you pay for him, and so forth. And these were all violations of the tampering rule. And then when he ultimately signed Matthews, suspension followed. And it wasn't intended to be a slap on the wrist, I can tell you. A year suspension is a serious business.
And then he came back and decided that he would be the manager. He got through that one day before the NL president, Mr. Finney.
Feeney
said no more of that shenanigans.
Yeah, it was not a good thing for
Major League Baseball and its integrity.
Yeah, people said, but again, Greg, Mac, after all, was an owner who managed the team, but Mac was an owner who had the professional background as a manager, whereas Turner did not, and it was not an appropriate thing for him to do.
Well, I think Connie Mack, although I met him when he came to Kansas City after the A's had moved there and all the pictures, he never wore a uniform, but he stayed in the dugout, and he was very much a baseball student as well as knowing the game and having a great deal of love for the game. So two different or three different, if you include Finley, quite different from those two guys. Given much of what you put down in your own book, with your permission, could we go to situation of the position of the baseball commissioner in 1992, particularly with Faye Vincent resigning or forced to resign here this past summer? I have heard that Faye Vincent was in a no-win situation, that the owners came to him asking him to solve the allocation of franchise fees for both the NL and AL teams. And his solution was to give each National League club $12 million and each American League club $3 million. And all the club owners in both leagues hollered foul, saying they weren't getting enough, and they blamed him, as well as the second issue of the realignment of the National League and putting the Cubs in the Western Division. So I guess to come down to it, the question is, can a person really be a commissioner of all of baseball, players, umpires, scouts, and not just the owners? And you served that position the second longest in the history of the game.
Well, I think clearly the commissioner can be the commissioner of all the game. And historically, I think the commissioners have done a pretty good job of it. I'm not saying it's an easy job, but I think it's a job that can be done. The question, I think, currently under consideration is whether the commissioner's powers need to be changed in some way. I think, if anything, the commissioner's powers should be strengthened and not lessened, and I would guess that the current review being made in the so-called restructuring process will will come out of this, I'm suggesting, is the right way to come out of it, and that is with the commissioner's power very much intact. If anything, I think the commissioner's powers may be enlarged.
But you think that may take a period of 2 or 3 years, and we might have a caretaker coming in shortly?
No, I don't. I think you'll have, before long, a period of months, if not less, you'll have a full-time commissioner, not a caretaker, and one who has the power to do the things that are needed to make the game work well.
But you say restructuring the responsibilities of the, that's really solely up to the baseball owners. They're not going to bring the umpires into that decision making or the players.
No, they're not. The restructuring of the commissioner's role is certainly one that's going to be determined by the owners and by the commissioner. Remember that the role of the commissioner was, and very much as it exists today, was largely shaped by Landis, the first commissioner, who dictated what he would accept and what he would not accept. When Ubroth came along, very much with my cooperation and advice, Ubroth did the same thing, and modifications were made in favor of the commissioner's power. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a new commissioner, before he accepts the job, behave very much in the way that both Ubroth and Landis did, by saying there will have to be certain additional powers or I won't take it.
If you want me, this is what comes with the job.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to ask you this. This comes from Saturday's Miami Herald, and where Steve Howe, who's been barred from baseball now on 2 separate occasions, is admitted cocaine addict, made millions of dollars, but an arbiter ruled last Thursday that Howe was eligible and able to come back to baseball immediately. Why is it that an arbiter would make that decision and not a baseball commissioner?
Well, the reason for that goes back to something we were talking about earlier, which is the modifications in the reserve system that were achieved by Miller in the early 70s, including the bringing in of an outside arbitrator in place of the commissioner. So that has a 20-year history behind it. And the reason you have a guy like Mr. Nicolau making that decision goes back 20 years to collective bargaining. Again, it was an effort to relax the reserve system, relax the player controls, to give them more assurance about the fairness of the system. And having been achieved, that modification has remained in place. I don't happen to like the decision made in the Howe case. I think you will find, incidentally, check the details, that he may have been suspended as many as 7 different times for drug abuse. I haven't seen the decision that Mr. Nicolau made, but I would certainly like to see it, because I cannot understand under what circumstances he could now be reinstated.
Well, I think that, of course, the Players Association came to his support 100%, but I just fail to see the logic of it, not to penalize a man, but if you say he's been suspended for the game at least 7 different occasions, there comes a point where you wonder, one, the benefit of the game, as well as when will rehabilitation eventually set in?
Well, I think in Howe's case it's going to be difficult to have a rehabilitation, at least judging by the history of the man. It's too bad, because he remains a rather talented ball player. But you have a very serious question here, not only of the man himself, but the impact this kind of ruling has on the public. How does the public see this? How do kids in the public see this in terms of saying no to drugs when a fellow like Howe, after repeated violations of the rules regarding drugs, is permitted to play Major League Baseball?
Yeah. baseball expansion. Of course, when I grew up, there were 16 major league teams, and only one of them west of the Mississippi, St. Louis Cardinals and the old St. Louis Browns. And we hear the cry of, more and more expansion, diluting the pool of talent. Although I think that within the next 15 years it will go beyond Canada. I think we might have it in the Dominican Republic and maybe Mexico City. But aside from the possibility of more clubs with a limited talent pool, I'm thinking about clubs being able to be financially viable, especially with the end of the TV revenue sharing contract. And I don't think that they're going to get the kind of money that they signed up with CBS earlier. I don't see the rich club. We're going to have rich clubs and poor clubs the way we did when I grew up as a kid. And if anything, I would argue that getting rid of, that won't be done, but getting rid of teams that financially are not solvent and won't be on a parity and can't compete with the richer clubs.
Well, there's always some risk that you develop an imbalanced situation. The free agent draft, which began in the 60s, was designed to create an equilibrium in the game, and I think it went a long way to do just that.
But have we come full circle from the old bonus signing days before the draft and to get rid of, to have greater parity, and we're coming full circle to what it was in the 30s and 40s and even earlier?
Well, I don't know if we are. I think there's a risk that the system could begin to tilt toward wealthier clubs, but you cannot judge that based on evidence of how the races have gone in recent years. You're getting quite a variety of clubs winning divisions.
And the clubs that have the highest salaries are not winning the pennants?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the Oakland, for instance, had a rather high salary and won its division. On the other hand, the Dodgers and the Red Sox had anything as higher salaries.
And the Mets, they had...
And the Mets, and they came out poorly. So I don't think salary in and of itself is the measure. You can spend a lot of money on salaries and still not do well, as is clearly demonstrated in 1992. So I think it's a little early yet to say that we have got...
For the phone call, I'd like to ask you, if you were, say, if I came up and I represented the baseball owners, and I said, Mr. Kuhn, we'd like to have you be the baseball commissioner again. And you'd say, Dan, I'm thinking about it, but this is what I would want. What authority would you want that, let's say, you felt that was not there when you were baseball commissioner? Let's say you were negotiating, and this is what I would want to be a baseball commissioner. Other than what's written and what you know about the job?
I don't think there's too much between myself and you, brought the changes that were made were really quite substantial. It made it clear that the commissioner indeed had very broad powers, really confirmed as much as anything the existing powers of the commissioner. I certainly felt no lack of power when I was commissioner. Any challenges that were made to things I did, and the things I did were fairly substantial here and there, all the challenges lost. So I think the powers are all right. If anything, if they were possibly to be extended, it might be in the area of labor negotiations. You can make an argument that the commissioner's authority should cover labor negotiations. At the present time, that responsibility belongs to the Player Relations Committee, which is an owner's committee. I'm not so certain that power should not belong directly to the commissioner so that he can run labor negotiations as, say, David Stern does in the NBA. I'm not convinced that that's the right change to make, but I think it's one that should be considered.
Certainly, David Stern's name's been brought up as, hey, wouldn't it be great to have him change addresses in New York City and move from the NBA to Park Avenue, up to 595 Park Avenue, I guess. He has been quite successful as the basketball commissioner in the sense that, from what I've read, he has had a minimal amount of interference from the owners. And he hasn't had to go around putting out one brush fire after another, consuming all of his time and energy, but has really negotiated in a fashion to make basketball increasingly popular in America. Whether in the Olympics this past summer or certainly the marketing aspect of it and the salary cap. Baseball has never gone after somebody in another sport to be its chief executive officer, but this may be the time to do it now, like a David Stern.
Well, David's a very capable man. Whether or not David would be interested in the job, I have no idea, but he's certainly a capable man. There are going to be a lot of very capable people who will want the job of baseball commissioner. One should discount the concern expressed in the press to the contrary. You will see very good people looking for the baseball commissioner's job. When they get into a search process, and I'm confident they will come up with somebody very capable.
My last question, sir. Even though I know some of it you have put in your book, but I'd like for you to say, of all the things that you're most proud of as commissioner, what were the top two areas that you would like to be known for the record in terms of your achievement as baseball commissioner?
Well, you will find this pretty well covered in the book,
yes.
But I had to pick out a couple of things, and I think it's what I said in the book would be that when I came in, the talk generally was about the decline of baseball, serious problem that baseball had, lost popularity, baseball allegedly dying, all of that. By the time I left, baseball was the fastest rising sport in the world, and I would take some considerable pleasure and satisfaction in that being so, included in its new list of assets was that it had become a gold medal sport. But was shortly about to become a gold medal sport in the Olympics, which is a great boon for the future development of baseball internationally, where I think its future is going to lie in any event in its international development. Beyond that, more than anything else, the commissioner is representing the interests of everybody in the game. Is charged with protecting the honesty and integrity of the game. 16 years I was there, that aspect of the game was well protected, and I take some pleasure in that.
Well, certainly, with your leadership, and I think all baseball commissioners, that the integrity of the game, with as much temptation and as with as many people, umpires, scouts, players, that since Judge Landis took over, there has not been that major hint of scandal that would affect it, except for the drug situation that we have going on today, and occasional outbursts of gambling, and I'm thinking there of Pete Rose's situation.
Yeah, I think baseball's had a good record and maintained a fairly rigorous attitude toward any improper influences.
Well, I run out of questions, right, given that much of it is in the book.
Yeah, you won't have any trouble.
Okay.
There's so much in there.
Okay, but
that's a 450-page book, and it was carefully thought out and worked out.
Well, I think that for the Baseball Hall of Fame, that it has your voice. I know you're on the board of directors, but they may capture your voice more at times than you think is needed, but I do appreciate your taking the time to spend a few minutes with me in this part of the interview anyway, sir.
Not at all.
Thank you.